Hello again, I'm Oren Almy. This year's midterm elections demonstrated once again that America is a nation divided. We've heard that again and again in discussions of campaigns across the country and in accounts of the voting. There's another side to the American story. As natural disasters and hate crimes have created victims, they've also led to outpourings of humanity, responses to the need for community in times of trouble. That's happened after California's deadly firestorms and in the aftermath of the killings at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pennsylvania. We'll hear some first-person stories, and later, we'll take a look at restoring the broken connection between the young and the old, something that's developed in this country over the past 100 years.
Older people went from being seen as a natural part of the cycle of life to old age being viewed as an incurable disease.
Let's go first to the Woolsey fire that destroyed so many homes in Malibu. And April Novotny is with us. She is a survivor of that fire. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us a bit about what happened to you, what your circumstances are now.
Our circumstances now, well, we're displaced. I'm a mom of two small girls, and we're kind of popping around in our third home, trying to get into a rental, and, you know, we're just rebuilding. We're just taking all the help that's been given, which has been overwhelming, and we're so grateful, and we're one foot in front of the other.
Tell us how that help came to you totally by surprise.
You know, I found out Friday, my husband was out of town. I was alone with my girls. They're 4 and 7. We had to evacuate at about 2:30 in the morning, and ended up sleeping on my uncle's couch. And the next day, in the afternoon, I found out that the house was gone. So, you know, I posted a little blurb on my social media just to let everybody know what's going on, because everyone's been watching. And on Saturday, I actually came back to my uncle's house after running out to Target for some necessities. And there were 4 strangers standing in his living room. And my uncle was crying, and I walked in, and this lady said to me, "Hi, you don't know me, but your friend, Jamie Premack Sullivan," she's somebody who lives in Alabama, "sent me." And they brought toys for the girls. They brought a bathrobe for me, some toiletries, a lot of hugs, a prayer. People are coming out of the woodwork. And I have to be honest, about 2 weeks ago, with the way the world is, I didn't see any of that humanity. And to be honest, the last week and a half, I haven't heard anybody talk about politics. I haven't heard anybody talk about who they voted for or how they feel about laws. It's seriously been the most beautiful thing, so tragically beautiful, this whole thing has been for our family.
Just tell us a little bit more about how it came to be and how somebody in Birmingham, Alabama was able to send somebody to your house, 4 people. Who were the 4 people and how'd they find out from Alabama?
You know, I wish that I remembered all their names. The mom's name was Nancy, and she had 2 beautiful girls who just embraced us. I have a friend, her name's Jamie Premack Sullivan, and she has a lot of people that she reaches with a show she does. It's called Coffee Talk. And she just put it out there. And the amount of people who reached out and said, "What can I do? How can I help them? I'm here." It's almost like she just reached out and touched us from across the country. And that's not the only story. There are just so many, like, it just keeps happening. People I don't know and people who know someone, it's beyond, like, we're all more connected than I think we understood before this happened to us.
You live in a mobile home community. Your home is now destroyed. You've indicated that sometimes the community was sort of at odds with one another. What happens now?
So our community is a co-op, and we all own the land together, so decisions have to be made. We're very divided. I mean, we're in a state of the world where we all feel very divided in our opinions, and for some reason we feel very defensive of our opinions also. We had a town meeting on Saturday, and there were hugs, there were tears, and a lot of smiles. And I think that, like I said, the tragedy really brings us together.
One of the things that caused you to be as depressed as you were prior to this was, of course, the borderline shooting that happened in Thousand Oaks, California, just a few days before the fire.
Yes, yes. So we actually, I went to borderline as a high schooler for, you know, they'd have line dancing lessons before line dancing, and it's something that the kids in the area did, and it really kept us out of trouble. So I'm connected to borderline, and that happened the day before we had to leave our home. But it's given me perspective. You know, I feel like in the grand scheme of what's going on, we get to rebuild. You know, my family's safe. We can rebuild. And some of these people can't. And I think it really gives us a broader view of what's really going on. And we're all here. And that was just stuff. And it's going to be hard. And it's really a pain and a bum. But we can do this. It's okay.
And, of course, there's been a great outpouring with regard to the borderline shootings as well. I heard a report earlier of 60 feet of flowers knee-deep in that area, obviously support of another kind. You can't bring people back, but you can, of course, speak to the survivors in that way. Another person involved with the Woolsey fire in a very different way is Kristen Childress. And Kristen, good to have you with us.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Tell us how you responded when you saw that the Malibu fire was getting to be what it was.
Well, we were actually watching it quite closely because my parents live in Westlake Village, so I was worried about them, and they ended up having to evacuate, and they came to us in the middle of the night, early Friday morning. So having them safe, again, like April said, you know, it's people, you realize, are the most important. So having them with me and knowing they were safe was huge, but watching the destruction happen on TV and not knowing if their house was going to be, you know, if they'd have a place to go home to, was you feel so helpless. And kind of, I was in the same sort of feeling the same way as April too, just with the state of the world. And it's so overwhelming, all the problems and the borderline. And I was feeling really down, and you feel like it's just so much that there's nothing you can really do to help. And then I found out about this place in Redondo Beach, Dive and Surf, that was collecting donations for the fire victims and also for firefighters, and bringing them there by boat because they couldn't get through on roads. And I just, my one daughter goes to school in Georgetown. She texted me about this Dive and Surf thing. And then my daughter Ainsley heard about it at school. And we just said, oh my gosh, we have to help. And so, you know, you feel like you can't, you know, solve all the problems, but you can at least be there for the firefighters, or, you know, do one, at least one small thing that you can do. So we found out about that basically through social media, and I called and found out what they needed, and we went to get the supplies. One thing that they asked for, I don't know why this one just really got to me, was eye drops for the firefighters, because obviously, you know, they're just on the front lines there in the flames, and I mean, that's such a small thing, but it's so needed. So we just loaded up everything that we could find and buy for them, and we brought it over to Dive and Surf, which is a dive shop in Redondo Beach, and expected that I would just be going into the store and, you know, there'd be like a little box for donations that I would place my items in. And we arrived there. It was overwhelming how many people were there, young and old, from all over the place. No place to park, just cars lined up, amazing volunteers coming out to unload the stuff. The outpouring was, I had already been crying all the time, crying while I was buying the eye drops, crying, you know, just, and then to see that, I was just so grateful to see the same thing like April was saying. You know, there's so much wrong in the world, but then when things like this happen, you just, people are people, and they want to help in any way, and to see this, I mean, I thought there'd be a small donation box. I mean, it was everywhere you turned was covered with clothes and food and medical supplies. You couldn't, it was amazing. I was so impressed with our community and It just, you know, every day I wake up and ask God to use me in some way, and I just felt like, ah, oh, this is it. You know, this is what it's about. It just was amazing.
Kristen Childress, one of the people who responded to the Woolsey fire. We all remember, of course, the tragic shooting at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh, where an anti-Semite killed 11 people. Sefi Kogan is the Global Director of Young Leadership at the New York-based American Jewish Committee. He's got a story about that. Sefi, great to have you with us.
Warren, it's my pleasure to be here.
Tell us what happened in the aftermath of that terrible, terrible tragedy in a country that has been welcoming to Jews over the years, for the most part.
Yeah, Warren, I have to say, you know, it's so inspiring to hear April and Kristen tell the stories of finding good in the depths of something so horrible like those fires out in California, and you know, I'm sitting here in New York, but I'm sure that I'm not alone on the Eastern Seaboard in thinking of all of you out there. The difference between what happened in Pittsburgh and what's happening in California, of course, is that nature doesn't hate. These fires are horrible, but they are not targeted. And so to see, for me, who doesn't use my my phone or any electricity on Shabbat, on the Jewish Sabbath, for me to then turn on my phone after Shabbat about a month ago now, and find this flood of emails, texts, to open Twitter and Facebook and read the full extent of what happened was truly, truly horrible. Along with my colleagues here at AJC, we worked together to come up with what the right response to something like that would be. And I've always felt that there's no better way to fight anti-Semitism than to be proudly Jewish, to go on doing the things that Jews do, and to do it in an unafraid way. And so we created Show Up for Shabbat, an online campaign, but not, you know, hashtag activism. We were really encouraging people to use the hashtag, but to do something in the real world. And to us, it seemed like the natural thing for people to do in response to 11 Jews being murdered while they prayed in a synagogue was to go to a synagogue themselves. And so we encouraged Jews to go to synagogue because we think that that's a great place for Jews to be at a trying time. And we encouraged through our network of community partners all across the United States and all around the world, we encouraged non-Jews who were looking for a way to show solidarity to also to join us in synagogue and to show up for Shabbat.
How shocked were you and other American Jews by this attack in Pittsburgh?
Yeah, look, Warren, I'm 27 years old, and I would hazard to say that most people in my generation just assume that this kind of thing couldn't happen here in America. You know, we're roughly in the season of Kristallnacht, which is the night when Nazis in Germany kind of the first pogrom that began the Holocaust, the Night of Broken Glass. So we know that this kind of violence is a part of Jewish history, of things that we've suffered in the past. But America, in so many ways, has been a second promised land for Jews. There's this great Gallup poll that comes out every year asking Americans which religion, the people of which religion they like the most. And actually, funnily enough, we Jews somehow always top that list in recent years. You know, I don't know what something like that means, but the way it's manifested itself is that we've felt quite comfortable here. Then suddenly to have that comfort shattered, you know, one of my colleagues has been calling this the end of American Jewish innocence. We know that there's been anti-Semitism in Europe for a long time. Again, we know that Jews in Israel suffer through acts of terrorism. But for us to fall victim to that here in America was really quite disturbing. And so having an opportunity like Show Up for Shabbat for people to step up and not just do something, but also feel embraced by their neighbors. We had a great outpouring from civic leaders, people like Eric Garcetti, your mayor right there in Los Angeles, who is Jewish, all the way to Sadiq Khan, the mayor of London, who is not Jewish, who happens to be Muslim, both of whom participated in Show Up for Shabbat, along with any number of other people all around the world. We saw on social media that the hashtag Show Up for Shabbat was used over 240 million times. When you kind of add that up and think about what that means in real world terms, we think that this was the largest act of solidarity with the Jewish people in world history.
What does it tell you about humanity itself and the basic needs of our species?
I think people look for comfort. I think that that people, when we're wounded, we turn to our own community for hugs, but we also turn to the communities all around us. I think that our country and indeed our world is strongest when we really make up this great patchwork of so many different intertwined communities of people. I heard incredible stories from all across the U.S., from all around the world of the churches and mosques and different groups sending over their clergy or some of their members to synagogue. There's just this incredible enveloping sense of warmth and support that people show in times like these. And, one man set out with hate in his heart and gunned down 11 people, but he didn't win in any sense of the imagination, because what happened was hundreds of millions of people stepping up with love and responding in the most beautiful way.
Sefi Kogan again with the American Jewish Committee, Show Up for Shabbat in the aftermath of the shooting at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh. You commented earlier on our other guests, and just quickly let me ask them, Kristen Childress, you were involved in rescuing people in the aftermath of the Woolsey fire. Just interested in your take on what we've just heard.
Oh my gosh, well, I just feel completely humbled by both of their stories. I think one thing that strikes me is just like basically a kind of like a circle of kindness. I mean, I feel like when something terrible happens, people's instinct is to want to help. And if you can help in any small way, then that act helps another person in tangible and intangible ways, because the people being helped, I think, feel, appreciate the help, but they also feel like someone else cares. Someone else who doesn't even know me cares about me. So that intangible love that you get from that, and then the person helping gets that feeling too. It just, it feels good to be able to help someone else. And I just, it's like Mr. Rogers said, look for the helpers after disasters. I mean, that is just something that I have tried to do, and to be able to be one, it's humbling for sure.
And April Novotny, you were one of those who was helped.
Yes, I was. And, to be honest, you hear these stories and you think of, who are we as human beings, and who are we, historically, and we came from social creatures, like we came from communal living. And I think that even though with the intelligence of human beings becoming more intense, we numb out these intrinsic qualities that we have as human beings. And I think that in a moment like this, we go back to that natural state and everything gets stripped from us and we become very primal. And once again, we're communal and we want to hold each other and help each other. And, you know, in the end, we all belong to each other. And I think we go back to that primal state when something so tragic happens to any of us.
Well, thank you all for being so eloquent about what you've experienced and what you've done for other people as well, and what other people have done for you, April and Kristen and Sefi. Great to talk with all of you. Thanks.
Beautiful. Thank you, so much. Doing this.
Thank you all so much, and really my best wishes to all of you. I hope
you
I hear there's
too.
Some rain headed your way, so I hope
too.
that calms things down.
Thank you.
There's a perennial joke that everybody gets older if they're lucky. But age often leads to a form of segregation that's not always recognized for what it is. It's an issue of increasing importance because Americans are living so much longer than ever before. Next year, for the first time, there will be more Americans over 60 than under 18. Some are looking at that as a coming calamity, but not Mark Friedman. He sees a moment of great opportunity. His latest book is How to Live Forever, The Enduring Power of Connecting the Generations. And Mark Friedman, it's great to talk with you.
Thanks so much, Warren. Likewise.
First of all, let's talk about what you describe as the history of age segregation. This is something that is relatively new.
It's really a phenomenon of the past century, and that was something I didn't realize before working on this book, but actually by the beginning of the last century, we were the most age-integrated society in the world. People worked in a mostly agrarian economy on farms, side by side with people of all ages. Multi-generational households were the norm. Even in one-room schoolhouses, students were oftentimes in their 30s or 40s learning next to children. And in fact, we were so thoroughly integrated by age that people didn't even have any awareness of age. The idea of chronological age was foreign to us in the 19th century and beforehand. We didn't celebrate birthdays. Knowing somebody's age would almost be like knowing somebody's blood type today. You'd never even think to ask. The birthday song wasn't even created until 1934. So we went from this thorough model of age integration to the most age segregated society in the world in the space of a century. And I was really curious about how that happened and how we could turn that around.
Just quickly, the Happy Birthday song was invented in 1934. They weren't celebrating birthdays until 1934?
There were no birthday parties. There were no birthday cards. And people were aware of the stages of life and of the wholeness of life. People were aware that some people were older and others were younger. But the notion of chronological age was completely foreign. The greeting card industry got involved and we started celebrating birthdays and having birthday cards and singing happy birthday to you. But even that wasn't until well into the 20th century.
How did it begin? Did somebody figure it out because they wanted to sell birthday cards?
You know, I think first the notion of efficiency, of industrial management, the idea of the division of labor started going beyond the assembly line into every aspect of life. And we began with universal schooling, grouping young people in finer and finer categories. Small children were in elementary schools, older children in high schools. We invented child labor laws, which removed children from the workforce. And at the same time, we were making education more efficient and organizing it by age. We were doing the same thing about later life. Older people went from being seen as a natural part of the cycle of life to old age being viewed as an incurable disease. And that led to the separation of older people, the creation of nursing homes, of senior-only facilities. And then the workplace went from being age-integrated to being restricted to people essentially in the middle. Social Security, probably our greatest social policy achievement of the last century, was enacted in 1935 and set 65 as the retirement age, based actually on the Prussian military pension eligibility age that Otto von Bismarck had set in the latter part of the 19th century, convinced the state would never pay a pension. And so we instituted that age of 65, and that, along with other measures, removed older people from the workforce. And so we ended up with a lockstep life course in which young people were shunted into education institutions at the beginning of life, older people into institutions exclusively for them in the later stages of life, and middle people in the workforce. And that became more and more ingrained as we went through the 20th century.
But let me ask you this. You talk about efficiency. Isn't it true that people of different ages are, in fact, able to do different things? Young people can't necessarily do the same things that adults can do. Older people can't do the things that they used to be able to do. So what's wrong with efficiency in that context?
You know, you can really understand why these decisions were made. And obviously, some of them, child labor laws, the enactment of Social Security, were huge progressive triumphs.
So you don't want to go back to child labor or get rid of retirement.
Exactly. You know, and I think that in general, we have to resist nostalgia for, you know, a lost age-integrated agrarian past where everybody got along. And I think what we need to do is find ways to extract the things that worked well in the past, but to do so in ways that fit the world we live in now and will be living in the decades ahead. But I think what happened is we went, you know, oftentimes from insights that were understandable and oftentimes justifiable in the context to an extreme version of segregation. So take the age 65 as retirement. Now, in 1935, somebody who's 65 years old was probably much less equipped than they were in an earlier part of their life to do industrial labor. But as John Chauvin, an economist at Stanford, points out, we would never use $1935 dollars in 2018 without adjusting them for inflation, yet we use the 1935 definition of being over the hill as if it was some eternal verity. And so we haven't, you know, there's much that we've lost along with the gains that happened through this reshuffling of society.
So one of the things then that you're pointing to is that we still have rules that don't apply even as people are getting older and older. Obviously, 65, people say this all the time, is really not necessarily the time when people can no longer do the work that they have been doing. And there's efforts to increase the retirement age, change Social Security, save money in it because of that, because younger people are having to support older people, even though the older people might still be able to work.
Absolutely. And I think my overall realization is that chronological age in 2018 is a lot less useful as a way of organizing society than it might have been at other junctures in the past.
Tell us about Sun City and other places where older people, in fact, chose to segregate themselves.
Yeah, Warren, I'm so glad you brought that up because I think that was a turning point for us. In the 1940s and 1950s, partly as a result of this growing age segregation in society, older people had really been shunted to the sidelines. Lewis Mumford, the great urban historian, said in the mid-1950s that no group in any society had ever been so rejected as older people today. And Walter Reuther, the UAW leader, described retirees as too old to work, too young to die. So older people were at the margins of society. They had no idea what to do with themselves. And they were living longer already. And so this period between the end of work and the end of life was growing, and a purpose gap was essentially filling that. And a set of leisure entrepreneurs, most notably Del Webb, who created Sun City, filled that void. And they filled it with a cultural ideal of a second youth, the golden years, graying as playing. And through the idea of age-segregated communities where older people could go off and in many ways perpetuate this illusion of being young again. And in fact, those two notions of an ideal for later life as an ersatz opportunity to recapture your youth and radical age segregation went hand in hand, because if everybody was old, nobody was old. The disruptive presence of children was eliminated along with school taxes. But it's interesting, even here, to go to your earlier point, that much of this started with the best of intentions. The first community that was focused on leisure for older people, age segregated, created in the Arizona desert, was Youngtown. It was created by a real estate developer named Big Ben Schleifer, who was an idealist. He saw the condition of older people in society and wanted to create a place for them that was modeled after the kibbutz in Israel, where there was a sense of community, of engagement, of having fun in life. And so he created Youngtown, and Del Webb was so impressed with the attention Youngtown was getting in the mid-1950s that on January 1st, 1960, he launched a much larger version, Sun City, in Peoria, Arizona.
So both of these were relatively close to Phoenix, but how much enforcement was there of the ban on children? I understand you could have a dog, but you couldn't have a kid.
Yeah, exactly. You know, that's, people don't realize it, but there is an exemption in housing discrimination laws for communities where the majority of people, I believe it's over 80%, are over the age of 50, or in some cases older than that. And it's this came to the forefront when Youngtown, which was the first of these communities, actually was the first AARP chapter in America as well, burst to national attention in the late 1990s for ejecting a couple, grandparents, who were caught harboring their grandson, who'd been in an abusive situation and had no place else to turn. They planted a sign on the lawn harboring children. They fined the couple $100 a day. And as you say, newspaper articles pointed out that in Youngtown, dogs were allowed, but not children. And they, in fact, were challenged by the Attorney General of Arizona and lost their age restriction because they had followed the rules carefully. But Sun City, across the street, with some 70,000 residents, had been more careful on the legal ins and outs, and today has a thriving force of age police following school buses around and ferreting out these pesky young people who could potentially bring about school taxes or even worse, puncture the illusion of eternal youth.
One of the problems of old age, as I understand it now, is loneliness. To what extent is loneliness caused by this kind of segregation that you're talking about, even if you do get not to have to pay school taxes anymore?
I had a very powerful example of just that kind of loneliness myself 2 years ago when I went to visit my father, who was in a nursing home in Philadelphia. And my father had been a teacher and a school administrator who, upon retirement, organized track meets for elementary school students in the Philadelphia public schools. And so I showed up at this new nursing home where he had been sent. And there wasn't a young person in sight. And I entered a room with 100 older people, all essentially in a state of of despair. And it was doubly ironic because I was driving out there. I was listening to my public radio station in Philadelphia that I'd listened to while growing up, and they played John Prine's wonderful song "Hello" in there about loneliness and in later life. And studies show that there's been a rapid increase in loneliness and social isolation among older people, but even more among younger people. Older and younger people are the two loneliest, most isolated groups in society. It's hard not to think that that's not an accident, that a society that's so radically separated older and younger people would be yielding a harvest of loneliness, of ageism, of purported conflict between kids and teens. And, you know, there are many factors, I'm sure, that contribute, including the mobility of our society. My example, living in California while my parents are in Philadelphia, is one illustration. But I think that this radical age segregation has been a grievous wound that's a self-inflicted one as well.
Obviously, there are health problems associated with loneliness of that kind, and it can be they can lead to physical disease.
It's really unnatural. I think that was also a discovery as I dove more deeply into the literature about human development. First of all, it turns out that many evolutionary anthropologists now believe that older people, particularly older women, were the critical difference in human beings evolving from primates. It was the role that grandmothers played taking care of children that enabled the long gestational period that separates human babies from all other animals and allows us to grow these large brains. So if you go back to the very beginnings of human history, older people and younger people were inextricably bound together, and it was a key to our progress. But even if you look at human development, I was struck in reading the literature about well-being in childhood and well-being in later life that the two most important studies ever done, longitudinal studies in child development and in adult development, fit together like pieces of a jigsaw puzzle. There's a 40-year study of resilient children done by University of California Davis psychologist Emmy Werner that shows that young people who make it against the odds have one thing in common, which is the presence of a caring adult, oftentimes an older person. And Yuri Bronfenbrenner, who founded the Head Start program, is one of the fathers of child development in America, puts it beautifully. He says, what every child needs is at least one adult who's irrationally crazy about them. And then you look at the other end of the age spectrum, George Vallon, who for 40 years led the Harvard study of adult development, the most significant study of happiness in adulthood, finds that older people who mentor younger people who are involved in the lives of the next generation are three times as likely to be happy as those who fail to do so. And he says it's human development at its core, that biology flows downhill, in his exquisite phrasing.
We're talking with Mark Friedman. This is the podcast of To the Point. His latest book is called How to Live Forever, The Enduring Power of Connecting the Generations. We'll talk about that subtitle in just a moment.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Warren Olney back with Mark Friedman. Once again, we're talking about how to live forever. It doesn't really mean that, but the enduring power of connecting the generations is another way of saying what it is that Mark Friedman thinks makes life at an older age not just tolerable, but in fact productive as well. So tell us a bit about how it is that young and old people can live together successfully and productively.
I think that we need to start with proximity, because when we were talking earlier about age segregation, it really was an effort to remove the generations from interacting with each other in daily life. And communities and housing and work in education. And what I've seen over the last few years is very simple efforts to bring people into each other's path. And what's been so remarkable about these innovations that I've encountered is that they started out with, in a way, their own kind of efficiency, and yet very quickly went into what could only be described as humanity. I'll give you an example. I visited Judson Manor, a retirement living facility in Cleveland, near Case Western University and the Cleveland Clinic, which had always been segregated by age, only older people living there, when one of the board members came up with the idea of having graduate music students at the Cleveland Institute of Music, which is just a couple blocks away, being given free housing at Judson Manor in return for playing concerts and other musical performances for the residents. And it was the idea that they'd enhance the cultural life and do an exchange for housing-strapped graduate students and culture-hungry older people. But very quickly, something much deeper blossomed, and I felt like that was encapsulated in the story of a young violist from the Cleveland Institute of Music who became engaged, married another young violist, and when it came time for their wedding, they asked their 90-something neighbor to be part of the wedding party. She became essentially like family, and it was by living next door to each other, having shared interests. And there's so many other examples of senior centers and preschools.
Tell us about Singapore.
Singapore is, I think, really heartening in the sense that it goes far beyond a small rays of hope. But Singapore is pouring $3 billion in Singaporean dollars, about $2.1 billion U.S. dollars into creating what they call a kampong for all ages, kampong being the Malay word for village. And they're trying to be the model as one of the most rapidly aging societies in the world for a future of intergenerational harmony. And they're doing it in common sense ways, creative ways. They're co-locating senior centers and preschools. They're building three-gen flats in which older people in the middle, and children can live together. They're creating playgrounds that are designed universally so that they fit the needs of older people and younger people. They've thought of everything, and they funded it. And it's really it's almost like a diorama of what our future could be.
In the United Kingdom, I understand that they now have a minister of loneliness to deal not just with lonely children, but with lonely adults as well. Tell us a little bit more about what's happened there, and particularly in London.
You know, it mirrors the realization here in the United States. There was a very powerful Harvard Business Review article by Vivek Murthy, the former Surgeon General, a year ago, which argues that the most significant public health issue faced by the United States today is loneliness. Murthy shows that being socially isolated is equivalent to smoking 15 cigarettes a day in terms of its adverse health impact. And in the UK, they've grabbed that issue in a very powerful way. And in addition to appointing a minister of loneliness and shining a light on the broader issue, I've seen an enormous upsurge of creative solutions at the grassroots level. One of my favorites is Now Teach, created by Financial Times columnist Lucy Kellaway in her late 50s, watching her daughter do the British equivalent of Teach for America, Teach First, being inspired by that. 2 years ago, wrote a column in the Financial Times announcing that she was quitting her job to become a math teacher in a low-income London school and challenging her readers of a certain age, over 50, to quit their jobs and join her in a Pied Piper-like fashion. And to her surprise and amazement, 1,000 people signed up for Now Teach, which originally had 20 slots of 50 people in their 50s, 60s, 70s, and beyond, agreed with Kellaway, quit their jobs and raised their hands to become teachers to invest in the next generation. They had 47 slots in the first year, more than double what they originally thought. But even more, it's created a national phenomenon in which older people are stepping forward to show their deep commitment to what happens to the next generation.
What do you say to people who look forward to being able to retire at age 65, let us say, after a job of toil and trouble, and be able to travel, be able to be on their own, not to have to worry about the kids? What about that dream of retirement of that kind that originally led to the creation of the retirement communities in the first place? What, is that dead?
It's not, and people should feel every bit that they have the right to do that, that that's a viable option. I think what I've been working towards is a society that provides alternatives, especially in the context of people living so much longer. Half the children born since 2000 in the developed world are projected to see their 100th birthday. So what it means is that people can afford to do that for a year or two or even a decade and then have enough time and energy for another act. And I think the notion of retirement that Del Webb pioneered and has become so much part of the American dream over the last half century was really designed for a life course closer to 70 than something approximating 50. And very few people now can afford a 30, 40-year vacation. And I think many people also are realizing that psychologically that's not going to sustain them or be a source of happiness and well-being. So I think we need to reorganize society so that allows people to get a well-deserved rest, but then also to, once they're rested and ready, to re-engage in ways that are personally meaningful, but that also can mean something beyond themselves.
What about the middle generation? What about the people who effectively are abandoning their parents and glad of it?
Well, I think one of the issues that we're facing here in America, and that's a global issue, is how we're going to take care of people at both ends of the life course, of children who are smaller in numbers than ever in the past and who are more precious in a way as a result of that, and a growing body of older people. The fastest growing segment of the older population is 85 and above. And given how long people are working in the middle years, given the geographic mobility in the country, the size of the country, we need to come up with new ways to do old things. A lot of that kind of care across the life course used to happen within families, but now families are often separated. So how do we come up with new social institutions that help us care for each other in this modern family world?
Should people get time off work to take care of their elderly parents just as they get time off work to take care of their young children?
Absolutely. And I think that goes to an earlier question you asked. We need to think differently about how we use time across these much longer lifespans. So there have even been suggestions that Social Security be focused on young families or people in the middle who are taking care of relatives and people work later. In many ways, we set up society for a very different kind of reality than we face today. And there's a great sociologist of aging who ran the National Institute of Aging named Matilda White Riley, and she had a theory that she called structural lag. And by that, she meant simply that people's lives change far more quickly than society can adapt to that. And so what we're seeing now is a lot of people scrambling in inhospitable societal arrangements to deal with real needs. I think, you know, also we need to try to create bonds among people who aren't related to create an expanded sense of family in ways where people get their needs met and yet do it in ways that extend beyond blood relations into the community.
Let me ask you about civic engagement. For so long, it's been the case that the electorate is not just whiter than the population as a whole, but also older than the population as a whole. This time around, in this midterm election, more young people voted. Is that a good thing? And do you think that that's perhaps a step toward young people recognizing the needs of older people?
It is. And I think older people need to recognize the needs of younger people. There's a spectacular short-lived innovation that was created by Ellen Goodman, the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, and Pat Schroeder, the former congresswoman, a number of years ago called Granny Voter. And its simple premise was that older people certainly should think about their own age group when they vote, but they should also think about their grandchildren and what's important for the next generation. And so I think there's tremendous self-interest across these age groups when it comes to voting and just about every other group, because, you know, those young people are going to be those older people sooner than they think. And those older people have their own grandchildren. So, you know, of all the purported divides in society, this one between age groups, I think is the most bridgeable, because it's all about the same people. Those young people will grow up to be older people, and those older people once were young people. And so I think we need to remind ourselves that we're all part of the same life cycle. But that's been something that we've found harder to do, I think, because of radical age segregation. We've lost a sense of the whole of life that we need to recapture.
How would you compare age segregation to racial segregation?
Well, I would say that age segregation is less well acknowledged. It's essentially hidden in plain sight, but it's becoming more and more urgent in the sense that, as you mentioned at the beginning, we are in 2019 crossing a Rubicon. For the first time ever, we'll have more older people than younger ones in society. And so this is no longer a glancing issue or something that we can ignore without much peril. This is one of the most profound transformations in the country. And so I think it's the absolute soil in which ageism is rooted, through not having encounters in daily life. I think many young people have distorted stereotypes of older people. The same is true. And so I really think that we need to surface this reality, see the damage that it's done, and begin in a concerted way to remedy it.
Where can we look for models?
I think this is a case where there are many global examples. As we were talking before about Singapore, the UK, because all throughout the planet, this phenomenon is unfolding already in countries like Japan, South Korea, Germany, Italy, Spain. They're on a path to have populations between 40% and 50% over the age of 60 by mid-century. So we're actually a relatively young nation. So there are wonderful global examples. But at the community level, I've seen innovators all over the country who are doing work like I was describing before at Judson Manor. And many of them are young people. There's a project started by two recent MIT planning graduates called Nesterly, which is pairing older people who have room to spare and need extra income and help with chores with young people who are in graduate school who can't afford rent in places like Boston and New York and Los Angeles. And they're bringing together two unmet needs in ways where everybody gains. And what's happening in the process is powerful relationships are forming between older and younger people because we're built for that kind of connection.
All right. Once again, there will be next year more Americans over 60 than under 18. That does not have to be the cause of new problems. And in fact, Mark Friedman has some solutions to problems that might occur before they have occurred. His book is How to Live Forever, The Enduring Power of Connecting the Generations. And Mark Friedman, it's been great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Likewise. Thank you, Warren.
Today's podcast was produced by Andrea Brody. Our engineer is Chuck Prevetary. And our special assistant was Chris Weatherspoon. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To The Point at kcrw.com, at Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts, or you could subscribe.